Open University. So my PhD is on the market transition of Uzbekistan, so a post-Soviet state. And in this paper in particular, I look at how market transition have affected gender. So this is like a typical economics department presentation. I'm really sorry about it, but yeah, I mean, this is interdisciplinary. So, so I will look at the context and the literature debate, the research question, my methodology, I implement mixed methods, results, and conclusion. This like is a work in progress, so any feedback would be highly appreciated. So let's start with the concept of market transition, and the way I define it and the literature of agrarian change, for instance, design is that it involves a deeper division of labor through new forms of wage relationship and labor exploitation, which is also affect a deepening of class stratification. It also affects the way assets and capital is accumulated and distributed in society. But in the literature of post-Soviet states, despite there has been a huge debate on, like, for instance, privatization and patterns of deindustrialization, there has been an under-investigated aspect on the gender. So I argue here that gender is actually a crucial analytical lens to comprehensively understand processes and outcome of market transition, both within and outside the market, and I look at the issue of productive and reproductive work. So, Uzbekistan. Uzbekistan is a country that's been independent now for like 26 years, so it's been born as a result of the collapse of the Soviet Union. And when I analyze these patterns of transformation, so the idea, for instance, that market transition don't only involve mechanism of reforms at the market level, but involves also broader transformation that are cultural and societal and affect, for instance, also gender norms. So I have to look at the historical roots of in this particular paper, I look at the issue of agriculture, looking at the structural literature, so how agriculture is actually is a source of surplus value and how this surplus affect gender but also the economy in the sense of patterns of accumulation at the national level, and how this has affected the class formation. So new patterns of what we call it now inequality, but is actually patterns of redistribution of wealth within the household and outside the household. And also what is really important in this, to understand the pattern of transition in post-Soviet states, to understand what has been the evolving nature of the state and how the state has affected relation of production and reproduction. So what is interesting about Uzbekistan is that, first of all, there is a high labor force participation in comparison to mid and low income countries, which is around 53%. And this is done, this is the product of the legacy of Soviet states. So during the Soviet Union, they had a quota system. So at the both in skilled and unskilled jobs, women had to be there 30%. 30% of the jobs has to be covered by women. So lawyers, doctors, blue collars had to be women. So this has also been a little bit the flip side of this paper, because paradoxically, there's been a de-Sovietification of gender norms as a result of market transition. So the idea that markets has actually dispossessed, through the abolishment of this quota system, through the depauperation of state investment on social welfare, there's been a decline in the power relations and in the political stance of women in Uzbekistan. And also this has affected particularly the more disadvantaged. So I look at the marginalities within the marginalities, so rural areas. So for instance, and I will talk through a little bit the fact that land titles have been transferred to men. So my point is that there is a slow pattern of private accumulation because the state still controls massively how assets are redistributed, but there's been a recent market liberalization that has been the spin-off through the commercialization of high-value crops. So Uzbek agriculture was based for 20 years around cotton and wheat, which were state crops where the state would actually acquire from farmers and sell it abroad to gain foreign currency. Part of the market transition has also resulted in a liberalization of fruits and vegetables. And these are creating new forms of accumulation. So my question is these new forms of marketization or commodification affecting gender, for instance, in dynamic proletarization? And what are basically the tensions that creates this negotiation of gender inequality, both at the level of the patriarchal norms, so of the pull factor, the societal norms present in the society, but also as push factors of what is the marketization and proletarization force going on. What is my analytical lens is food. And food is because of its material specificity, and within the sector of agriculture, because of agriculture is actually food production, not only, but mainly food production, is actually able to explain what have been the gender inequality within forms of production and reproduction. In reproduction, because obviously food is not only produced in the fields, but it has to be processed, prepared, and consumed within the household, but also at the productive level, because it affects relations of production, wage-labor relationship, and for instance, asset to physical nature means of production, such as land. So the methodology is basically, as I said, a mixed method. I did my fieldwork in 2015. I collected through purposive survey, I'm not sure if you are about that survey, farmer survey, 120 interviews, and 16 were females, and this is indicative of the domination of men within agriculture, so the fact that land farmers are mostly men because land is assigned to them. I also look at time use to understand patterns of reproductive and productive work. I look obviously at land ownership and productive and reproductive activities, and I also conducted to actually fill the gap of these 16 respondents in the quantitative survey. I conducted participant observation in both Samarkand and Tashkent, which are basically my agricultural site. Samarkand and Tashkent is the capital, so the urban middle class, and focus groups with students. Because of cotton production, so there is a child labor involvement in cotton sphere and mostly at women, so I went to a school and asked about what is your activities in terms of cotton collection to understand this kind of discrimination. So let's start with the results. This is a very random question, you might think. Who goes to buy food in your family? And the majority of the, you might think that this is part of reproductive work, so it's something that women has devoted to do, to go by shopping. Instead, in Uzbekistan, it's mostly husbands, so it's a man. And this is given by, the reason why is because women, even if they work, do not have access to money. So the budget and the budget capacity and decision-making process on the budget is monopolized by men. So men are taking the opportunity of going to buy shopping to retain the control over money. So at the end of how this, like the complex, these are like a little bit of the complexity of reproductive work. Nevertheless, when you ask who prepares meals in your family, you can see that mostly wife and daughter-in-law are those who are devoted to this type of tasks. And that means, and is also linked to the debate about the mainstreaming women in formal labor process and the disempowerment that this labor integration can affect along generations. So what happens in Uzbekistan is that if the mother goes to work in a formal labor, who is actually affected in terms of burden of reproductive work, meaning preparing food, is the daughter-in-law. So there is along the same gender line, there are repeated patterns of discrimination. This is like a literature that has been mentioned in the previous paper, the fact that one of the indicators that both in historically in the welfare state in the early 90s in this country, but in now in the literature of gender in low-income countries, what you see as an indicator of discrimination is that, okay, this is I have to explain the background of this methodology. This is a dietary diversity survey. So the five is the lowest food groups that the respondent had access to. 22 is the highest food groups. More is higher, better is your dietary diversity. It means your nutrition is better. As you can see, men have access to a higher dietary diversity than women. And this means that even if women prepare the food, it is qualitatively being observed that those who have access, for instance, to more protein-rich or to bigger size are men. Okay? Another point that is being often mentioned in the literature is about the classification and the recognition of work done by women. So in my survey I asked, do your wife work outside the home? And they said, most predominantly they said no. But when I rephrase the question and ask, do your wife work or help in the farm, in your farm, they say yes. So it's basically this narrative of delegitimizing women's work is actually, first, highly evident, and second, affected and reinforces patterns of discrimination in the household in the sense of redistribution of assets. So, in summary, men have exclusionary access to land. Women are constantly exposed to dynamic of expropriation, both legitimized outside hello, Pedro. Both legitimized outside the household and inside the household, and the fact of being women's work not recognized by the social norms makes, first of all, women not monetized, work not monetized, and reinforces dynamic of patriarchy. This is actually perpetuates the still transition to a deeper and formal division of labor, and it's also affected the commodification of food. So the fact that there is no demand for women's work outside the households, it perpetuates the condition for women to stay at work and be the actually the one who takes care of all the domestic and reproductive work, which subsidizes wages in the formal labor market. So it creates a subsidies for wages. It also creates an inflationary effect for food, and basically reinforces the vicious cycle of women stayed at home producing unmonetized labor work that subsidize social reproduction. The new trend that I was talking at the beginning is that there has been a spin-off of liberalization going on. And this is the open question that Pearson and all the feminist political economists are actually questioning, whether this formal labor is an indicator of empowerment, because from my fieldwork, what happened is that women have been absorbed by agro-processing companies, and they, although they gain, they earn less than men, they first of all have a stable access to income, Second of all, they have access to a canteen, so they have free lunch. And third, they possibly could, because legitimized in a system of social protection and within the workplace, that could potentially trigger dynamic of organization. At the same time, they obviously have gender-specific skills, which are unskilled and mostly manual. They obviously earn a third less than men, and they are exposed to dynamic vulnerability within the workplace and outside the workplace, not individually, but along the same gender line. So for the reason I was anticipating, that the fact that if they go outside the household to work, someone else within, I mean, the women's sphere has to take responsibility for their reproductive labor. So the conclusion is that the gender transition in Uzbek agriculture can be traced, but not exclusively, by the pattern of commodification. The development of job opportunity in the agro-processing industry are shaping new patterns of labor structure, which are absorbing many new patriarchal-dominated regimes, possibly, outside the household. But this obviously creates new tensions of renegotiation, because it doesn't mean that they will not be expropriated, dominated, patriarchy will be recreated in other forms. So the outcomes obviously depends on the bottom-up powers of organizing, how the women organization will be able to challenge social norms, but also advocate for like state policies that regulate both capital and labor and social protection. So the idea of the Soviet Union, where women were paradoxically advertised as the progressive ones because integrated in the formal labor market, but they were still, I mean, although responsible for the household reproductive work, supported by a system of welfare. This is also proof, and this is connected with the smart economics and gender mainstream approach, which says that this is a unidirectional system of empowerment of women that is indicative of their higher participation in the labor market. Because if you look at the historical trend of what happened in the former Soviet Union and in Uzbekistan in particular, this case study disproves the linear thesis of smart economics. We basically see gender equality as a result of economic growth. So we assisted, obviously, to a process of economic expansion and liberalization of process of capital and private capital accumulation. But paradoxically, in terms of social norms, women have been deinstitutionalized and delegitimized of the rights that they were acquired during the Soviet Union. Yeah, I'm done. Thank you.
Presentation is part of my ongoing PhD research in Brazil, State University of Campinas. My supervisor is here, Ricardo Antunes, Professor Ricardo Antunes. And I don't know if you guys know the term here, the Caceres. Have you ever heard about this? But the object of my research is Brazilian immigrants living in Japan, known as the Caceres. Brazil is the country with the largest descendants community of Japanese people outside, and we have about 2 million descendants. The history of Japanese migration to Brazil dates back to the beginning of the 20th century. Afterwards, since the 1990s, we have the reserve flow of migration, that is, descendants of Japanese migrating to Japan. These immigrants are known as the Kasegis. The word the Kasegi originates from the Japanese word noun that is derived from two verbs, deru, which is go out, and the kasego, the act of making money through work, meaning the person leaving his own her home country to work for a certain period elsewhere. Nowadays, we understand as the kasegi phenomenon, the migratory flow of Brazilian for working unskilled market niches in Japan. Before I begin to present my research, I would like to point out that I speak as a researcher. However, I also speak as the subject of my own research. Because I lived in Japan for 10 years as a daughter of Brazilian workers who migrated to Japan and worked in outsourced factory. I spent my childhood and youth in working class neighborhood in the city of Toyota. Toyota the cars, the Toyota? And the same where the Toyota company is located. I did my whole basic education in Japanese schools. And last year, I recently returned to Japan. I spent 1 year doing research for my ongoing PhD, this research. And I did a kind of ethnographic research in a working class neighborhood in the city of the same city, Toyota. And I conducted 44 interviews with Brazilian and Peruvian immigrants. So, some questions that guided my research were, well, what are the similarities of immigrant work? What is the difference between this and the national worker? How are race, ethnicity, and gender categories combined to construct the idea of another within the class society? How the mobilization of those categories serve to lower the price of national labor force? The price of national labor force, as well as engender political fragmentation within the working class. In order to not restrict myself only to those aspects, I also try to look at the joint construction of joint resistance between immigrants and Japanese in the period of economic crisis, such as the ones 2008 and 2009, and there were resistance in that period. My original hypothesis was the crossing, or whatever you call intersection, of these categories, such as gender, race, and class, would tend to enhance the domination-exploitation relationship of the affect subjects. Thus, the central goal of the research was to understand this dynamics in local, in Japan, that is through field research within the Kasegis workers themselves. First of all, it's worth mentioning that one unique thing about Brazilian migration in Japan is kind of different than here, because they are being documented, not illegal, and highly bureaucratic when compared to other countries, like here or United States. The Kasegi social phenomenon itself began in 1990 when Japanese government made a migration law reform, along with Japanese descendants like me, Nikkei, or of up to third generation worldwide to obtain residence visa up for 3 years in Japan. So I went there in '90s. Formally, this is not a visa work, but residence visa, which is different from here maybe. In other words, through consanguinity. That is a selective migration to non-skilled jobs, seeking to recruit a population similar to national population, where there was no tension regarding a supposed ethnic homogeneity that would please the local conservative population. It's kind of visa to not disturb, to get similar people to doesn't have some cultural shock. They assume that descendants of Japanese will have a work ethos similar to their own. So I will list some information for understanding the Kasegi situation. Nowadays, right now, about 190,000 Brazilians live in Japan, being one of the largest community of foreigners. Even after 30 years of migratory phenomenon, Brazilians continue to be inserted in the same migratory niche, that is, the automobile industry, like Toyota, and electronic industry. Some Brazilians work in the service sector, however, those services are aimed to the Brazilian community in Japan. The factory in which they work are called kaisha, which means factory in Japanese. And they are small and medium-sized outsourced factory of large company such as Toyota, Mitsubishi, Honda, among other giant companies. In this factory, the Japanese workers still have formal labor contracts, and while almost Brazilians and or other immigrants find themselves in informal sector. So there is a clear polarization between unskilled and skilled immigrants. This is a polarization among other aspects, manifests itself in like the concentration of Brazilian in worker in industrial centers, such city as Toyohashi, Toyota, Nagoya, Oizumi, and Okazaki. On the other hand, the immigrants from central economies country, and they are skilled immigrants, live in large and urban centers, which Saskia Sassen called the global city, such as Tokyo or Osaka. The workers I interviewed work on the assembly line under the Toyota production system. There is a very strong sexual division of labor within the factory in terms of jobs for women as well as salary. For immigrants or the Kasegis, the salary is paid per hour, unlike for Japanese, who are paid by month. Brazilian women earn on average 20 to 30% less than the Kasegi men. Brazilians have a very long working day, up to 10, 12, or 40 hours of daily work. Working long hours is the only way to save money and dream of returning to Brazil. The average salary is not very low, being about $9 to $10 per hour for women, and for men it's really different, $12 or $30 per hour. By the end of the month, the average de Kasegi salary can range for $1,500 for women and $3,000 for men. It's not that low. However, for Japanese factories, obviously, there is an advantage in hiring Brazilian in order to reduce social security costs, because we don't have security or social protection. Moreover, as it happens here in Europe, newcomers, immigrants tend to earn less. Newcomers, I mean the people East Asia, Vietnam, Bangladesh, and other countries. So the work of Brazilian is more and more replaced by the works of Asian trainees with a decrease in the salary. There is a fragmentation of contracts form. Also, wage individualization is quite usual. The types of work contracts can be four. Arubaito, which kind of temp work, which came from German word, Arbeit, I don't know how to pronounce. Outsourcing, part-time job, limited-term work, which can be 3 months renewable. That is, the trend is flexibility and formality of the contractual relations. The Japanese who are in the factory have stability, as I said. So Brazilians serve as bumpers of the impacts of the economic crisis, such as in 2008, because they are located in margins of the contractual relation and more dispensable. In this context, the health impact in the worker is quite large. The karoshi, I don't know if you guys know the word, which means death by overwork in Japanese, and karoji satsu, which means the suicide by overwork, became trademarks of the current working class in Japan. In 2010, there were over 700 cases of karoji satsu, the suicide by work, in a universe of 30,000 annual suicide in the country, in Japan. So, why does Japan still need the immigrant workforce? Which was my question. Today in Japan, we have what we call demographic crisis. That is a population decline, low fertility rate, and the aging of the population. People over 65 years old are already 26% of the population, being the highest percentage in history. Also, other people over 75 correspond to 20.5% of the population, representing only 8 people. According to an estimation by United Nations, if Japan persists with this demographic crisis, in 2100, the population could fall to 83 million, which means 30% of them over 65. In addition to encouraging the fertility rate to increase, the incentive to attract more immigrants has always been a solution found by countries with labor shortage. Companies that hire foreigners are 152,000 right now, within an equal increase of 11% according to this same government report. Even with data above, the foreign population in Japan remains low comparing here in Europe or United States. It's just only 1.7% of population are foreign. When compared to other countries of central economies, in the Japanese case, being an island, the culture and the language considered difficult to penetrate, and the restrictive migration policy to unskilled immigrants are the possible factors for this small amount compared here. Also, immigration attractions policies are always a matter of national controversy, considered by many conservative governments and by the population as possible generators of disturbances. I agree with Susan Ferguson and David McNally when they said, the great proletarian fertility decline demonstrates that generational renewal of working class is a social historical process, powerfully influenced by women's reproductive choices. Instead of leaving this process to the workers' drives for self-presentation, preservation, and propagation, as Marx suggested, capital increasingly turning to the state, promoting laws that strictly regulated birth control and abortion, while also advancing immigration policies that reflect capital's need for a substantial reserve army of labor. There was Susan Ferguson McNally words. In Japan, the lack of daycare centers for children, the high costs of reproducing new families, and the increase of women participation in the labor market mean that women increasingly choose to have few children and even marry less right now. So, returning to the beginning of my communication speech, I believe that to understand the particularity of immigrant work, we have to look at Japanese working class as a whole. That said, I conclude my communication showing some data that exemplify how the greater influx of foreign workers in recent years is in sync with the decline of working conditions in Japanese whole societies. By 2018, more than 37% of Japanese workforce is informal, mostly in the service sector. In the case of women, this number rises to more than 50% of the workforce, the informal people. The existence of poor workers, the increase of outsourcing and workers receiving government aid, the contingent of cyber refugees, I can talk about later. There are people who are homeless and live in net cafes, which is kind of a great phenomenon there, are growing up year by year. That is, the entry of immigrant population serves to compress the price of the labor force and to increase class domination through the mobilization of oppressions. Thus, the low cost of the labor force and reproduction of the next generation of immigrants is guaranteed by the segmentation of these labor forces, as well as by the legitimizing the reproduction of already existing gender and race oppression in society, thereby reconfigurating and empowering exploitation and oppression. Oh, that's it. Thank you very much for attention, and sorry if it's confused.
What can explain the persistence of gendered oppression in a society where decades of feminist struggle has ensured women almost the same legal standing as men? In the liberal imagination, history is the journey towards ever greater equality, and whatever there still remains of gender oppression is at most a residue of a less enlightened past. For conservatives and the far right alike, the appropriate level of gender equality has been achieved in the West, and any oppression of women in Europe is the result of migrants bringing the supposedly backwards culture with them. But what if gender oppression is not a mere hangover from a non-capitalist past, but rather central to the organization of capital? In her book, Family Values, Melita Kupka argues that the constitution of sovereign liberal personhood depends on what this is about, namely a form of subjectivity that creates community and dependence. For Cooper, this matters in neoliberal politics because this politics simultaneously celebrates individualism and depends on traditional family values. She writes that, quote, "The neoliberal position does not so much eliminate moral philosophy as posits an imminent ethics of virtue and a spontaneous order of family values that it expects to arise automatically from the mechanisms of the free market system. The nature of family altruism in some sense represents an internal exception to the free market, an imminent order of non-contractual obligations and inalienable services without which the world of contract would cease to function," end of quote. This contradicts much of the theoretical work that has viewed neoliberalism as the disappearance of traditional values, including the heteronormative nuclear family. But individualism cannot subsist on its own, since people are vulnerable and require other people to meet the needs for care. Liberalism produces split forms of subjectivity, one hegemonic form and one that is necessary for that hegemony to persist. The term possessive individualism, coined by Sigrid McPherson, is helpful for understanding the constitution of hegemonic subjectivity under capitalism. As McPherson writes, "Its possessive quality is found in its conception of the individual as essentially the proprietor of his own person and capacities, owing nothing to society for them. The individual was seen neither as a moral whole nor as part of a larger social whole, but an owner of himself. The individual, it was thought, is free in as much as he is the proprietor of his person and capacities," end of quote. I want to emphasize the unevenness of this form of subjectivity, as not every subject can inhabit possessive individualism to an equal degree. As the hegemonic subject position of capitalism, it hides other forms of subjectivity. Furthermore, possessive individualism can be understood as the commodity form of subjectivity. According to Marx, the commodity appears to have an inherent value, thus hiding the social source of that value. The commodity form makes invisible the labour that it took to produce that commodity. We can note that possessive individualism is a result of the commodification of our capacity to labour, so that such capacity appears as a commodity belonging to ourselves and thus ours to sell for a wage. Like in the case of the commodity form, the form of possessive individualism makes invisible the labour that goes into forming that very subject position. Here we come to the question of the unevenness of possessive individualism. Its production is not an automatic result of capitalist economic relations, but requires continual reaffirmation. This labour becomes invisible through the very form of possessive individualism, as a possessive subject can only appear to owe his capacities to himself. As social reproduction theory is identified, there lives a contradiction at the heart of capitalism. While this economic system has separated people from the resources they need to live, it must simultaneously keep a lot of people alive. This has historically been solved through a dual capitalist strategy of the wage and the family. Wage work became contractual and limited to a set period, but the family implies a lifetime of unwaged work, and while heavily regulated in law, it is understood as the opposite of contractual and rational relations. The wage provides resources, but these are not in themselves sufficient to meet our needs. The family, in its modern form, has functioned to prepare those resources for consumption as well as being the central site for meeting our emotional needs. But the effort it takes to maintain the family unit is not evenly distributed, but rather tends to fall disproportionately on one member of the family. In order to highlight this, feminists have applied the terms labour and work to these unseen efforts. In the words of Silvia Federici, they say it is love, we say it is unpaid work. The concept of emotional labour, coined by sociologist Olli Hochschild, originally denoted the increasing importance of the commodification of emotion in various types of service work. But the term has come to be applied more broadly to cover unwaged as well as wage work of emotional services. Emotional labour, in both its waged and unwaged forms, is the work of trying to change the emotional states of others. This often implies a certain bodily or verbal performance of the feeling one wishes to induce in the other. It can also involve trying to change one's own emotional state in order to impact that of others. It therefore implies a reworking of one's own subjectivity as well as that of another person. For the recipient of emotional care, its long-term effect can be a sense of stability and safety, as well as the sense of status that comes with having one's needs met. Emotional labour can enhance the sense of individuality as one's personal emotional needs are continually met and one's value as a person is reaffirmed. For the person performing emotional labour, there might both be the reward of being a good person and the depleted forms of subjectivity that comes with having to carry the burden of another person's needs and emotional states. Emotional labour implies putting the needs of others first and at least implicitly enhancing the status of other people above yourself. This dynamic is familiar for those who work in service jobs that where it's important to instill a positive emotion in others or neutralize the negative emotions such as anger or stress. It is also common in family dynamics, which according to Federici functions as a sort of safety valve in the capitalist economy, a site where negative feeling that has been suppressed in the workplace can be expressed and neutralized. Emotional labor is not merely concerned with maintaining existing relationships, but creating such relationships in the first place. That is why the subject of emotional labor is the opposite of that of possessive individualism. It is a subject fundamentally concerned with building the relationality of society. Capitalist subjectivity is thus organized around the split between possessive individualism and emotional altruism, a split that maps onto gendered subjectivity. The labor of building effective relations is structurally hidden in a world where the term work appears as the opposite of intimacy and emotion. The construct of individualism is related to the supposed emotionality of women. Individualism is built around self-possession, the control of one's emotional life. Women are constructed as lacking precisely the ability to be the masters of their own feelings. Femininity is thus the condition of not being a sovereign individual, but rather being the victim of emotional states. Femininity, furthermore, implies having to privilege the needs of others above those of the self, thus further abstaining from claims to sovereignty. Through the framework of gender complementarity, the emotional work that women do is constructed as something men lack or are incapable of doing. This so-called incapacity has absolved men of the responsibility for care work, while simultaneously hiding their own emotional needs. Through the separation of masculinity and emotion, men are excused from carrying out emotional labor while appearing as self-made and not owing anything to the people who have cared for them. Because womanhood has been constructed as the privileging of the needs of others, feminized people can make little claim to their own time and efforts. But ownership of one's own capacities is a fundamental requirement for being able to sell one's labor power on the market. In Capital Volume 1, Marx writes that proletarian men have acted as slave dealers, selling the labor power of their wives and children. But since then, the feminist movement has struggled for women's right to control their own bodies and capacities, making it more difficult for men to claim the ownership of their female family members. Liberal feminists in particular have centered efforts on endowing women with formal rights. If women can be turned into the carriers of rights, they argued, they could participate in political and economical life on the same terms as men. Social and Marxist feminists were quick to point out that equality with proletarian men, that is, the equality of exploitation, was not what they wanted. Furthermore, the liberal feminist position did nothing to solve the question of material and emotional needs, which is central to gender dynamics. If they offered any kind of solution to this problem, it was mediated through the market. Predictably, this allowed for white bourgeois women to adopt a position of sovereignty and possessive individualism while paying working class women of color to meet many of the needs of their families. But they simultaneously retained the claim to be the primary emotional carers for their husband and children. Cameron Lynn MacDonald, in her study of middle and upper class mothers and their nannies, found that so-called career women were likely to position themselves as mothers first and foremost. Unwaged forms of labor have a fundamental impact on how people inhabit their positions within the capitalist system of work, who can be constructed as an unattached, disembodied, and abstract worker. Even the most privileged women find themselves caught between the contradictory demands posed by the dual subjectivity necessitated by the capitalist economic system. In the socialist and Marxist feminist tradition, reproduction has often been placed on the side of the good, the logic that stands against capitalism. But this maintains the very distinction between production and reproduction that feminists have sought to dissolve. Reproduction, moreover, is fundamental to maintaining the world as it is. In our ideas of what constitutes a good life, what constitutes flourishing, we often accept as givens the forms of emotional satisfaction that we expect from nuclear families. These fantasies of a good life fulfill an emotional need, but can also stop us from struggling for a different world. Today, love is the opium of the people. In order to undo some of these dynamics, we need to rethink how we organize care, but also what kind of care that we need. Socialist feminism, while having led many important struggles, have sometimes started from the position of what working families need to sustain themselves, rather than thinking of abolishing the family and work. We should ask what counts as a good life and what counts as successful reproduction. Queerness, for example, can be thought of as non-successful reproduction in the sense that it disrupts the family and the reproduction of generations. We can think of queer reproduction as a refusal to reproduce heteronormative families. Family relationships and the emotional bonds that they produce are not internal, but can be changed through this resistance. The split forms of subjectivity constructed in capitalist economies need to be challenged and denaturalized, both from the side of spurious individualism and that of compulsory altruism. They can be changed through the demand that care is recognized as work, as was the primary aim of the Wages for Housework campaign. Naming these relationships as work and demanding a wage changes these relationships and removes them from the being constructed as the invisible opposite of market relations. In the words of Federici again, more smiles, more money, nothing will be so powerful in destroying the healing virtues of a smile. The feminist movement has also been successful when mobilizing anger. Anger can be seen as the refusal of feminized emotional labor, that is, the imperative to absorb the negative emotions of others and create a general spirit of niceness. In fostering anger, feminists are laying claim to a traditionally masculine emotion, the expression of power, but turning it towards destabilizing the status quo. In refusing to reproduce it, and the good life as we know it, in using strikes and labor tactics, and strategically using negative emotions, the feminist movement can create a world beyond individualism and compulsory altruism, beyond the expectations of the workplace and the home. Thank you.